Time to take a look at the world of insects on the Ideas Network. Now I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you back with my guest, P.J. Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll talk about those yellow jackets that may be bugging you. We'll hear about grasshoppers, lady beetles, and of course, certainly you can join in. I hope you do. Maybe you've got a fun fact you know about insects in the fall. Which bugs have been stuck to your plants or maybe to your house? Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. P.J. Leash, good to have you back. Thanks for joining in.
Always a pleasure to be here, Larry.
You know, a few falls ago, I was out doing some work in my back lawn, and I had an open can of something, some sort of pop. I don't remember what it was. Anyway, I took a swig and discovered that there was a yellow jacket inside the can, and gave me a little sting before I got it spit out, I guess I could put it that way. They can be a little aggressive this time of the year.
They can be, and there's a really good reason for that, Larry, and to put it shortly, they're basically hangry. They are really hungry this time of the year because they're running low on food. So one important thing to understand about these yellow jackets is they have annual colonies. So every year, the colony in late summer produces a batch of new queens and males. Those leave, they mate. All the members of the colony die except for those new queens. Those overwinter. In the spring, it's a mad dash and really a battle to duke it out and try and establish nests. And the nests are small in the spring. It's one female. It's that new queen. She has to do all the work. But eventually, if she's successful, she builds a workforce. And her workforce keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it peaks right around this time of the year. Now, the reason that's important to understand is there's a lot of mouths to feed in that colony when it's at peak size. They're trying to raise larvae. They've got all these workers to feed. Also around that same time, their food supply, which is often insect prey, is starting to decline as plants are senescing for the fall. So they're running out of food. They get desperate. They start going to pop cans and barbecues and things like that looking for food. And that's why we end up with so many human run-ins this time of the year.
Are there any reliable ways to kind of deter them? Although I can tell you, I watch my any open container when I'm outside. I've got something on it on the cover.
Yeah, so there's no great ways to deter them entirely. A few things may help to a certain extent, as you just mentioned, Larry. Keeping food and pop cans and things like that covered can be really helpful. That way you're not going to get a surprise of having one inside there. If they do seem to be very, very active in your yard, rather than eating out on your back deck, it may make sense to eat inside and then go out after that without food and beverages to enjoy outdoor activities. If you can, though, this would take some diligent observation. If you can observe them and follow them back to a nest and find where the nest is and potentially treat it, that would be something you could do that would have more of an impact. But I do want to mention these yellow jackets, they're not just pests. They can be a nuisance when they come to our barbecues and pop cans and things like that, but they do a lot of good things as well. They can be beneficial predators. They can be pollinators as well this time of the year, especially on plants like goldenrod. I see a lot of them. So they're not all bad. They do some good out there as well. So I really tell folks, when you have a nest around, you know, you have to make some decisions. If it's right outside your front door, yeah, you probably need to do something about it. If the nest is way in the corner of your backyard, no one goes back there, you could consider leaving it. But technically, if you found the nest and eliminated it, that would probably help with the amount of workers coming up to forage around your food and beverages.
And it's all going to be over. I don't know if soon is the right term, but when does it stop being a problem? Maybe that's the better way to put it.
Yeah, and I can't give you a hard calendar date, but for a lot of us in Wisconsin, it's probably going to be sometime in about the next month or so usually sometime in October. You know, if the weather stays pretty warm, you can bump into stragglers into November, depending on where you're located. But usually over the next month, the month of October, things start really quieting down. But in the meantime, the next couple of weeks, we could see a lot of yellow jacket activity, you know, especially if you're having cookouts, if you're at the apple orchard picking apples and there's fallen apples, they can be on that as well. So it's something we're going to be seeing a lot of in the near future.
And where does, so the queens are left, where do they spend the winter?
They look for a general spot to hunker down. So that might be in amongst mulch on the ground, potentially. It could be inside of a partially hollow, rotten log or under the loose bark of a tree that is maybe having bark sloughing off of it. They could sometimes potentially get into structures through little nooks and crannies in siding, but they're really looking for some sort of tucked away spot. From their point of view, they would want to hunker down, not burn through energy reserves, and just wait out the winter and then become active again in spring. So they want a spot that's going to be insulated, not too cold, not too hot either.
Beth in Mequon has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Larry. I don't know who the expert was on bugs that when I called quite a few months ago, but I wanted to give them so many thanks because we had a sewer fly problem for 4 years. And whoever it was suggested that the apartment company really needed to get a plumber in there and figure it out. And they did that, and they figured it out. We haven't had one sewer fly, and I'm so happy.
Well, Beth, thank you very much for calling. I can't remember. Was that UPJ or was that?
That very well could have been. I feel this year has been a pretty good year for questions on like sewer and drain flies and things like that. So it does sound familiar. I'm really glad to hear we got it figured out. When I do bump into things like drain flies, especially in larger structures, it just makes me wonder, is there a crack in a sewer pipe? And if you get that fixed, that seems to take care of things.
Thanks again, Beth. Appreciate the call. Well, Christina in Glenwood, we'll go to you. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. We have a large colony of hornets nesting in the metal siding of our home. We have used 5 cans of that hornet spray. And when that happened, that caused them to come into the house, I guess, to exit another area. So I'm wondering, what can we do to get rid of them and how to prevent it for next year?
Okay. Couple of thoughts there. So when it comes to controlling wasps, and in this case, based on the description, I can tell it's really a type of cavity nesting yellow jackets. And this time of the year, I get a lot of calls and folks think it's maybe ground bees or something else, but it's almost always yellow jackets, which is why we're talking about it on the show today. So some yellow jackets nest in the ground. Some make these aerial paper mache type nests. Some will look for pre-existing cavities or voids. They can get around the edges of siding, up into soffit areas, and get into a wall void or other tucked away location like that. When it comes to dealing with yellow jacket nests, and again, if they're close to your house, you may need to treat and eliminate the nest. If it's an exposed nest, you can look up and you can see it above your front door. That is where the aerosol sprays come in handy. When the nest is tucked away and essentially inaccessible, the sprays work very, very poorly. Now, also the common sprays that you can find at the hardware store typically contain an ingredient from a group of insecticides we call the pyrethroids. What's interesting about these pyrethroids is they can have repellent properties. They can work quickly. So again, if that nest is exposed, it works very quickly to take them out. But if you spray it in a spot where they're coming in and out of a siding and those droplets settle and stick there, it might actually repel them from that area and force them to look for other ways out, which is why in this case, they probably ended up popping out in your home. What works much, much better in cases like this is rather than an aerosol formulation, it might contain the same ingredients, but it's formulated differently as a dust or powder. And this would be applied with a device called a bulb duster, although sometimes you can find products at the hardware store that come in a kind of a squeeze or puff bottle with a little nozzle on it. You puff that into the entrance. You'd want to do it at night when they're inactive. Those products don't seem to be as repellent. And then as the insects come and go, they end up picking up the dust particles, essentially on the hairs on their body. We technically call those hairs seedy, but the hair-like structures on their body, they then track it deeper into the nest, and that tends to work much better. So in a case like this, we would want to find a dust-type product that says you can use it to treat yellow jackets, and then find the spot where they seem to be coming in and out of the most at the moment. That may be on the outside of your structure, that could be on the inside. You just make sure to check the product label, make sure you can apply it both inside and out. And then we would puff that into that spot. That usually does the trick. In a case like this, because you've tried some things, it hasn't worked the best. If you continue to struggle with that, then I'd maybe recommend reaching out to a pest control professional, because they will have the sorts of products and tools on hand to be able to treat nests like this. But it comes down to a formulation, not the aerosol. We want the dust in this sort of case.
And for preventing it in the future, would you?
Yeah, a couple thoughts on that. With siding, when you look at most homes, you know, your siding isn't necessarily super snug sometimes, especially vinyl siding. That can be really hard to seal up all those individual nooks and crannies. Still, you could do some things we'd refer to as physical exclusion. Look for potential entrance points any time of the year. Essentially, seal that up. If they can't get in spring to find a nesting spot, they're not going to establish a nest there. Another thing that can be really helpful, I mentioned earlier in the show, their nests build up from one queen in the spring to massive population of workers this time of the year. If we notice things early and can treat it earlier in the season, then we don't have the sting concerns that we have this time of the year when the colony is at peak size. So that can be very helpful as well.
Christina, thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Mary in Green Bay next. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to say that every year we have at least one. This year we have three active nests on our property. I found that if I just leave them alone, they haven't bothered us at all. One of them is inside of the far end of my shed. That one's quite large now. And there's one actually inside my chicken run, maybe 2 or 3 feet above my head. And they just seem docile and calm with me around. So I was wondering if your guests have any idea about the behaviors of them in terms of, do they recognize when people are a threat, or does waving your arms and being erratic around them maybe make them more cautious of you? Just that sort of thing.
Sure.
Yeah, well, they definitely use visual cues and things like movement. So if you get too close to a nest, let's say you're next to a nest with your friend and you disturb the nest and they get angry from that, the person who is flailing and more active is probably going to draw their attention more versus someone who's calm, moving slowly, and so on. So they definitely use some visual cues. When it comes to yellow jackets, so there's a bunch of different species. We have 10 or more different species in the Midwest alone. Sometimes there can be differences in colony size, how aggressive or ornery is essentially the personality of the nest as well. But this does bring up a good point. Sometimes there are nests that just don't seem to be terribly ornery. And one option is, if you can tolerate them and they tolerate you, you can just leave them be. And that colony is naturally going to die out sometime in the fall. So just because you have a nest doesn't necessarily mean that you have to treat it.
Mary, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. What about you? Question about insects in your neighborhood? I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The one number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or go ahead and email us. We've even got a photo that we're going to be talking about, too. You can do that to send it to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking insects with PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. PJ, Marion emailed us with a picture. Did you see were you able to see the photo? Good. They've recently found those insect eggs on a favorite bur oak tree, and the picture looks like an oak tree leaf, bur oak leaf. They're wondering if they should take the leaves off the tree on which the eggs are found. Photograph also shows a caterpillar that was found on another leaf nearby. Not sure if it had anything to do with the eggs.
Yeah, so in this case, we're actually talking about two different things. So let's talk about the egg-like structure first. So on this bur oak leaf on the underside, there's this cluster of these reddish, round spherical objects. It almost looks like a cluster of small grapes that's kind of glued onto the underside of that leaf. And even though they look egg-like, these actually are not eggs. These are a type of gall. A gall is an unusual plant growth or structure in response to a stimulus. That could be an insect, a plant disease, virus, some other thing. A lot of things can cause galls. Oaks are very, very well known for their insect galls. And in this case, on this bur oak, it's a type of gall called the clustered midrib gall. And there's a tiny type of wasp from the family Cynipidae. These are about maybe 2 millimeters or so long. The female lays eggs. It causes this stimulus, and you get this little cluster of these odd growths. Now, the good news about this is it's essentially harmless to the tree. It really poses no risk to the tree's health. It's more of a curiosity. And if you start looking at oak trees in general, I would probably challenge you. It's probably harder to find an oak tree that doesn't have galls on it somewhere. Most oaks are probably going to have one, if not multiple types of galls. They can be on the leaves, they can be on the twigs or petioles, things like that. And what I tell folks is you usually just shrug your shoulders and you don't have to do anything. There's nothing really effective to do to get rid of them anyway. So you just kind of note what they are, and they're a cool curiosity. Now, the caterpillar in this case is completely unrelated. This looks like a species, probably the American dagger moth, which is a really common widespread species, can be associated with a wide range of plants. And it's one of the common caterpillars that I can see out there, especially in late summer.
Judy in Stevens Point has a question for you, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry and PJ. I'm anxious to hear your opinion on this. I have a favorite insect, which comes into the house about this time of the year, and by that time it's almost dying. It's about 1 inch long, light tan, has a very skinny body, and because it's near death, I eventually squish it. But this is the best part: when you squish it, it has this wonderful lemony, citrusy scent to it, and I don't know if you can identify it from that, or you could put me on the track to finding out more about it.
Yeah, interesting. In this case, either seeing a photo of it or a physical sample would be really helpful. One clue that stands out to me, though, is the scent associated with it. My suspicion is it may be a type of insect from a group we call the order Hemiptera, or the true bugs. These are things such as stink bugs, conifer seed bugs, and the like. There are some of these that will feed on various plants, and they can accumulate or use some of the plant compounds and use that for other purposes in their body. And so I can think of several members of that group that could have kind of this pine or citrusy type smell if you were to crush them. So just from the description, I would think something along those lines. But if you ever see one and you can snap a photo and email that to me at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, or put one in a little container and mail it to me, then I can give you a much more definitive answer.
There you go, Judy. Thank you so much. Speaking of identification, Barbara in Middleton emailed us a photo of an insect about 2 inches long. That's pretty long.
Yeah, this is a good size insect, Larry, and this is one of our largest insects in the state. It's called a giant water bug. Giant because of, the impressive size at about 2 inches long. They are a type of aquatic true bug. So they're from that order Hemiptera I just mentioned. So they're related somewhat to stink bugs and things like that. But these live in bodies of water, ponds, lakes, rivers, streams. They can also be pretty strong flyers. And especially in late summer, early fall, sometimes they can be attracted to lights at night. Another name for them is the electric light bug. And I actually get a surprising number of reports of these at like football stadiums, because the lights can draw these in from very long distances. They can fly and end up in locations like that. In the picture, we can see these two front legs that actually look like really big pinchers or mouth parts.
Yeah.
Those are what we would call raptorial forelegs, raptor-like bird of prey. These are designed or evolved to be able to grab their prey. They hold it close to the insect's mouth, and then it uses this beak-like mouth part to inject some enzymes that start to liquefy its prey. So this is one of the few insects out there that I would generally be pretty wary of picking up barehanded, because if it were to bite your finger, that's not going to be a very pleasant experience. But if you just leave them be, they're really pretty harmless. A very cool-looking insect, though, all around.
And Joe emailed us a photo. He found this black swallowtail caterpillar on his parsley this morning. Should he wait until spring to clean up his garden bed?
Yeah, that might not be a bad idea. Otherwise, you could keep a close eye on this one, because my suspicion is it's probably just about done feeding for the year. And if you can kind of figure out where in the nearby area it makes its chrysalis, you could remove that and set it aside someplace safe before doing a fall cleanup. If you don't know where that is and you hack plants and remove them out of there, you might be removing that butterfly with it, and it probably wouldn't make it at that point.
Kim in Elk Mound, we go to you now. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Larry. I have a quick question about a new insect I saw this summer. We had these black-looking wasps in front of our house. Where the sidewalk meets the front of the house, there's kind of a crack along that line. And every day there was like 5 to 10 of those out there. And I think they are maybe mud daubers. But I'm kind of curious as to why, from reading about them, I don't understand why they were going down in that crack between the two buildings constantly. And then sometimes I'd see little mounds of dirt pushed out between that crack on the sidewalk. And they're quite aggressive. Well, maybe not that's too aggressive. We never got stung or anything, but they don't like you around there at all. And I'm wondering if they were, in fact, mud daubers, and why they would build, I guess, their nest in a crack like that in the sidewalk or between buildings.
Yeah, interesting. Based on the description, I don't think that these would have been mud daubers. However, when you start looking at mud daubers and related wasps from the same or close related families, there's a lot that can be dark colored. When I think of mud daubers, they are making nests out of mud, often on the sides of buildings and structures and things like that. So based on nesting location, I think it's something else. What it almost certainly is would be some type of solitary ground nesting wasp. Now, these creatures are solitary, meaning each female has her own nest. And because they have no colony of adult relatives to defend, the chances of being stung is going to be very, very low for these. Sometimes they may fly around you if you're a little too close, but to actually be stung by these, you'd probably have to grab one of them barehanded and be mean to it, at which point, you know, you're maybe asking for it if you're doing that, but generally they tend to leave you alone. The story with these, it would depend on the exact species. I've got a couple possibilities in mind. There's one called a great black wasp. There's some other families as well, but they go out and dig a small tube-like nest in the ground. They then hunt specifically for certain types of prey. So some types of these wasps will hunt for grasshoppers or katydids. They stuff that down in the nest. They lay eggs. That's what their larvae feed and develop on. There are some other ones that can fit that profile that are a little on the smaller side, maybe more like half an inch long or so, that will specifically hunt spiders, the spider wasps, and they will do that same kind of thing. They go down into the ground and will provision that nest with spiders. So I'd almost have to see some photos of these, know a little bit more about the description of them to narrow down potential suspects, but there's a bunch of wasps that do this that will nest in the ground. As I mentioned, unless you were to grab one barehanded, they tend to leave you alone, and stings are going to be pretty rare.
Kim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Peter says he knows that spiders in the house are beneficial, but where should he draw the line? How many is too much?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Larry. I mean, it really comes down to personal preference and kind of comfort level. I know intuitively some folks just are not fans of spiders. I think things would be a little bit different if spiders, when you were to look at them or pick them up and hold them, if they just kind of sat there. But a lot of cases, they try to scurry away very quickly. They're probably a lot more afraid of you than we should be of them. But if we were able to kind of enjoy and view them and observe them more easily, then folks might be a little bit more understanding compared to some of our insects. Now, as the caller mentioned, if you have spiders around your house, they are beneficial. They're going to be helping you out one way or another. If you just judge and make that call that I've got a few too many and you don't want that many, a few things you could do. The first is to keep in mind that if you have spiders around, you must have some insects or other creatures around that they're feeding on. In a lot of cases, those insects may be coming in from outdoors. So one thing I would recommend would be to look at your house or structure. Can you identify cracks, crevices where they may be sneaking in from and perhaps seal things up better? If that prevents an influx of insects from outside and we cut off their prey, that might help lessen their numbers in the long run. A few other things you could consider doing, glue board or sticky traps you can get at most hardware stores. Those can be handy to put out in tucked away spots in basements. If you have kids and pets around, you want to keep them away from those because it's just really, really sticky glue. But that can be a way through attrition to remove spiders and centipedes and things like that. That can be helpful. If absolutely needed, there are some treatments you can get at the hardware store, some sprays. And you don't need to spray everywhere, but sometimes tucked away nooks and crannies where spiders like to hide in basement furnace rooms and things like that, that might be helpful as well. Otherwise, in a lot of cases at my own house, I tend to collect the spiders in a little Tupperware or something like that. If family members want them removed, and I just let them go outside. But it really comes down to personal preference in terms of how many you're willing to tolerate.
Ralph in Northern Illinois, we go to you now. Hi, Ralph. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a beekeeper, and I occasionally put things outside after honey harvest to have them cleaned by bees and other pollinators. And I keep them real far away from my hives so they don't go into a robbing state. But I've seen vast numbers of what I think are called bald-faced hornets this year, and there's got to be a nest of them somewhere near my home. I mean, I'm talking 40, 50 of them come in at a time. And they're not aggressive at all. I can walk right up to them, and they don't worry about me at all. And they're not the smartest insect species I've ever met. They really end up drowning in honey if there's honey or water around. But I was wondering if that's typical of them when they're feeding, or is it just the batch I got?
Yeah, it doesn't really surprise me too much to hear this observation. And I do wonder a bit if there may be a nest very close by if you're getting that many showing up at those the combs you have set out. Now, bald-faced hornets, even though they have the word hornet in their name, they're not a true hornet. That's a different genus of wasp, the genus Vespa, which is related to them. But bald-faced hornets are technically in our yellow jacket group, which is a big theme for today's show. As I mentioned earlier, these have annual colonies. So that bald-faced hornet nest is basically at peak size right now. They have a lot of mouths to feed back in the colony. So they are desperate looking for resources. Now, if we took the honeycombs away, where would they be going? They may be scavenging on people food and pop cans, stuff like that. Otherwise, out in nature, they would be going to flowers for nectar as a fuel source. So because we have that sugar source available for them, remnants of honey and things like that, they are simply showing up. One thing you could consider doing if you didn't like this, you could watch and observe them and just see, because they're fairly large yellow jackets, probably our biggest yellow jacket species, you might be able to watch the direction that they fly back in. The bald-faced hornets make these very, very large paper mache type nests. And when I say large, I'm talking like basketball size large. They're usually almost always up in trees, although sometimes if you have a tree with a very dense canopy like a maple, You might have no idea that it's even there until the leaves fall off the tree later this fall. And so if you could find it and track down where it is, if it's low enough to treat it, you could potentially stop this if you deemed it to be an issue. Otherwise, they're simply trying to find resources to take back to the colony to feed all the members of the colony right now.
Ralph, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Marty in Athens. Hi, Marty.
Yes, I had a question for your guest. I've heard of the emerald ash borer, and now there's I thought I heard a new invasive bug. I don't know if it's a moth or what, that's supposedly going to start damaging the maple trees. Do you know what I'm talking about?
My suspicion is you may be referring to an insect called the Asian longhorn beetle, which can cause problems with maple trees and some other trees as well. Some good news for us here in Wisconsin, we don't have it around. Keeping my fingers crossed, hopefully we never see it around here. We have had that insect in the country for quite a while. It's been around for at least a decade or two. It is having more problems out on kind of the eastern coast. And some other good news is we have had some success in eradicating that one from certain spots. It does take a lot of effort cutting down trees to deal with and that sort of thing, but we have had nationally some success doing that compared to emerald ash borer, which we haven't been able to do a whole lot to really slow down. That one has really become established, widespread. Asian longhorn beetle, it's more of individual kind of little hot spots on the map, and there aren't too many of them. So that's some good news, is I think the threat from that one overall is going to be much lower than something like emerald ash borer.
Marty, thanks again. Let's go to Mike in Lake Mills. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I was just wondering if your expert had some comments. I'm really enjoy bumblebees and the other pollinators, and many of our neighbors spray their lawns in spring attempting to control noxious insects. And I'm just wondering, are any of those measures specific, or are they generally going to affect the beneficial insects like pollinators as well as the targets?
Yeah, great question. When it comes to lawn treatments, it'd be really good to know specifically what is applied, because there's a lot of things that get applied to lawns. We've got fertilizer. In a lot of cases, lawn care companies and homeowners are applying herbicides specifically for weed control. Those herbicides usually don't have a huge impact directly on the insects. Sometimes they can have some subtle ones. But if herbicides are taking out flowering plants from a lawn, which can include weeds like dandelion and clover, that is indirectly taking out some food sources for those insects. So there can be some subtle impacts there with another type of pesticide, fungicides, which are occasionally used to deal with various fungal pathogens in turf grass settings. Certain fungicides can have some subtle impacts on bees. That's been documented in the literature. But if we're talking about insecticides, these would be used for grub control in lawns, control of various caterpillars and chinch bugs in lawns and things like that. Those can have much more immediate direct impacts on insects. Some of those tend to be pretty broad spectrum products, like the treatments typically done or commonly done for chinch bugs, some of our caterpillar pests. Those are very broad spectrum products. And so if there were pollinators in that area at the time, that's almost certainly going to harm them. Another type of product that can be used, especially for grub treatments, are neonicotinoid treatments. We know that the ingredients in those products can be highly toxic to bees and other pollinators. And so if you have a lawn that is treated with a grub control treatment and it's a neonicotinoid ingredient and there are flowering weeds in that lawn, that could be a really bad situation, because you have those flowering plants attracting bees and pollinators in, and they could be harmed by those neonicotinoid insecticides. So when it comes to lawn treatments for something like grubs, my philosophy is really make sure that you indeed have a problem with those grubs. Are they present? Are they present in numbers that would warrant treatment? A healthy, robust lawn can withstand a lot of grubs, maybe 6, 8, 10 per square foot before you'd even know that they're there. But if you dig and you find dozens and dozens and dozens of grubs, yeah, then you could maybe make that judgment call to use a product. There's still some precautions. There's an extension publication out there that lists a number of precautions you can take to help mitigate and minimize issues, concerns for bees and pollinators. But to get back to the root of that question, yes, some of the lawn treatments can pose some notable concerns for bees and other pollinators.
Mike, thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Doug in Sister Bay next. Hi, Doug.
Hello. Hey, I have a question. I had a lot of bees, bee-type insect, on our bird feeder, our bird bath, and I took a picture of them with Google Lens, and it says that it's an Africanized honeybee, or killer bee, in parentheses, and I don't know if they're really around here or what, but I found a nest in amongst the spreading yews on the ground that's about the size of a volleyball or maybe even a basketball, something like that. And I'm wondering, if I didn't really want to take them out. My wife got stung 3 times by them. They seem to be pretty aggressive. You get near the area and all of a sudden they come swarming up out of there. And but, you know, they seem to be pollinating around the area.
Yeah, Doug, thanks for calling. What do you think, PJ?
Yeah, so a couple thoughts here. And one really interesting topic is the use of smartphone apps. We should probably do a show on this sometime, Larry, in the future. But they can be a double-edged sword. They can be really helpful in some cases. I see very, very regularly where they make some pretty significant errors. In terms of Africanized bees, we do not have them up here in Wisconsin. There's some establishment in, far, far to the south of us, but no issues here. Now, based on the description of the nest, these actually sound like one of our species of ground nesting yellow jackets. And I've had lots and lots of calls with these this year. I've actually had not one, but 2 nests of these in my own yard this year to deal with. And that's the classic description of these. You get too close to it, they come out, they can sting you, because they're ornery and a little bit defensive. But that's definitely what it sounds like what it is ground nesting yellow jackets. If needed, if they seem to be an issue and stings are occurring, you may need to draw that line in the sand and treat these. Rather than aerosol spray, you'd want to use either a dust-type product, or at the hardware store, you can find products that are formulated as an expanding foam. They come with a straw, just like a can of WD-40. You can direct that down into the nest at night. You dispense it, it foams up very quickly, and that often will do the trick. So if need be in a case like that, that is how you could deal with that particular nest for these ground nesting yellow jackets.
Doug, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. PJ Leash, our guest today, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Lots of questions coming in today about insects with our guest, PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today. PJ, Kathleen emailed us. She thinks the caller who mentioned the new invasive species harming maple trees was likely talking about the spotted lanternfly. A horrible insect to be sure, she says. And I wanted to ask you about it anyway, so I think it's probably a good time to comment.
Yeah, so that is another possibility as well. Spotted lanternfly is not here in Wisconsin yet. It's something that I've been watching very, very closely for the last couple of years now. This is an insect that popped up several years ago in Pennsylvania. It's now well established in the Mid-Atlantic region. It's making its way westward over time. We've had some detections in Indiana, Ohio, part of lower Michigan, for example. So it's something that we are keeping a close eye on, myself, colleagues in Department of Ag and DNR, and others as well in the state. It can potentially impact maple trees. It can impact other trees as well. I mean, in terms of the impacts, though, it's probably not the type of thing that is going to kill trees. It just tends to be kind of a sticky mess. What these insects do is they pierce the bark of trees with their needle-like mouthparts. They drink fluid. They ooze out extra fluid. That can lead to some mold and fungus and yeast growth on the trunks or base of trees, which can just be a really sticky and unsightly issue. But again, it's not the sort of thing that will kill trees entirely. So again, that spotted lanternfly is something I'm keeping an eye out for in the state. Possible it could show up in the coming years, but we've been lucky so far. And also one other point about spotted lanternfly, there was a modeling study that looked at climate a few years ago and looked at the entire U.S. to figure out where might this insect really establish itself and have significant impacts. And for Wisconsin, it was pretty mixed. If you go south of us, places like Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, a lot of really good habitat there based on winter temperatures and that sort of thing. For Wisconsin, perhaps a sliver in the southeast corner might be higher priority. A lot of the state is going to be kind of marginal in terms of suitability for habitat, and northern Wisconsin is expected to be basically unusable for this insect, given our current climate conditions. So it probably will have some sort of impacts in the state. I'd be more concerned about plants such as grapes. We know that grapes, a horticultural, agricultural crop, can be damaged, and sometimes vines can be killed by this insect as well. So again, it's one of these non-native insects that I've got on my radar, as well as a number of other species.
Mike in Wausau has a question for you. PJ, let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. Calling regarding, I'm a chainsaw carver, and I run into frequently when I'm working on white pine logs, there's a larva that infects the log. It makes a hole about slightly smaller diameter than a pencil. And if you're really quiet and you put your ear to the log, you can hear them eating in there.
Yeah.
You know, they're chewing. And what I'm asking is there anything I can do to, I don't want to use insecticides, to maybe kill off the ones that are in the log? Because the problem is once the carving's done, if there are any of them in there, woodpeckers will take the log apart.
Yeah.
Yes, based on the description, what I'm thinking of in this case, it sounds like Sawyer beetles. And these are insects that are really common. They're from the longhorn beetle group. So if you see the adults of this particular beetle, they tend to be blackish, but with very long antennae that can actually be longer than the body itself. Now, what these insects do in a natural forest ecosystem is they're going typically to trees that are dead or in the process of dying, and they tend to leave healthy trees alone. But if you have a tree that you cut down to use for lumber or other purposes, if you cut that tree and it sits there, to the insect and the insect's point of view, it's thinking, here's a dead tree. And so they can go and colonize that log. So one consideration you could think about is if there is some way to shift in the course of the season when trees are cut down and when they are processed and utilized. If you were to cut down trees in, say, spring, and they sit there for months and months when these insects are active, then that's going to give them a good shot at colonizing those. Versus if maybe you made the decision to cut some of these trees later in the year when temps are cooler, the insect is not active or do things during the winter months, that could be a way to avoid potentially some of that damage to the wood.
There you go, Mike. Thank you for calling. Phyllis in the town of Dunn. On to you now. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A couple of weeks ago, I went out with my scythe to cut down the tall grass on some derelict garden beds. And I learned a lesson. I want everybody else to learn it too. Just before you go scything a place like that, watch it for a while. Because all of a sudden I heard buzzing, and then I got 12 stings as I ran back to the house, and they came in the house with me and all that. But then later when I went back and looked, it's like a very busy airport as they go in and out of the ground there. And they're about a little less than half an inch long. I took a picture. And they're very dark. I mean, they have yellow and black stripes, but the overall impression is that they're black. And first of all, I wonder what they are. And then second, I think I gather from what you've told other people that they'll just die with the frost, and the queen won't settle there again.
Yes, I think that's true. PJ, go ahead.
Yes, that is correct. And what it sounds like in this case is it's probably ground nesting yellow jackets. When I bump into cases like this, you have a nest of some sort of social insect in the ground this time of the year. Really, the two possibilities it comes down to would be ground nesting yellow jackets or bumblebees. And usually folks recognize bumblebees because they're a little bit more robust. Some of the species can be pretty large, although there are some smaller bumblebees. But it sounds like a case of ground nesting yellow jackets. And as the caller mentioned, if you just can leave that area alone and wait, they will die out on their own later this fall.
Phyllis, thank you. Helen in Big Bend, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I'm concerned that we are not seeing insects this summer. We usually would always have wasps underlining our overhang of our roof with nests in every little nook and cranny. And we've only seen like two Japanese beetles. We haven't had any mosquitoes, but about two. We have a pond. We don't use pesticides. We did see some dragonflies a few weeks ago, and we do have the gray squash bugs on the squash, but I'm just concerned what are the birds eating. I do have one bat, but I don't know if it could eat all that.
Bats can eat a bit, but what do you think, PJ?
Yeah, this year has been interesting in terms of insect activity, and really every year is going to be a little bit different in terms of the trends that I pick up on going throughout the state and the region. I think a big driver this year has been our kind of wonky weather conditions we've had, unusually dry. I haven't peeked at the U.S. Drought Monitor in a few days. But we know a lot of the state is running a deficit in terms of moisture. Versus if we had a year with much more typical or average rainfall, that would certainly account for things like the mosquitoes. With Japanese beetles, both this year and last year, for the most part, the southern half of the state, we have had a reprieve here. There's been a few hot spots here and there, but for the most part, Japanese beetle populations have been fairly low, I think because of dry conditions. If the ground is really dry in times of the year like July and August, when female Japanese beetles are trying to lay eggs, the ground might be too dry for them. They might essentially decide this isn't a good spot to lay eggs and try going elsewhere. Or if they lay eggs and it's too dry, those eggs may not make it. Or if the grubs hatch, they may not make it. So I think the drought has been having a really big impact on a lot of insects this year. There are some insects like grasshoppers that have thrived with the drought. There are other ones like mosquitoes that in some areas have been very, very low populations. And it's having impacts on a very wide range of insects. So personally, I'm going to be really curious to see next year, if we ended up having a more typical rainfall year, will things kind of bounce back? Because I think the weather can have direct impacts on some insects. It may also have indirect impacts in terms of affecting plants and other aspects of the environment that influence insect survival and reproduction too. So I think weather is a big factor here.
Helen, thanks for calling. Don in Lafayette County, it's your turn. Hi, Don.
Good morning. Yes, I wondered if you could identify a small little metallic green, and it looks like a bee, but they don't bother you or anything like that, but they're kind of living in old logs, but it's very small. It's only about a quarter of an inch long, and it's all metallic green.
Okay. What it sounds like in this case, it's most likely a type of sweat bee, the family Halictidae. We have some members of that group that can be really common that are either an entirely metallic greenish color, or there are some that I like to say are essentially Green Bay Packer colors. They're green with some yellow and some stripes on it, some white on there too. But some of these species will go to hollow logs where there have maybe been other insect tunnels present, and they'll crawl in and utilize some of the pre-existing tunnel infrastructure in there for their nest. These are solitary bees, and because they don't have a big colony, they tend to be really kind of docile and unlikely to sting. You'd probably have to grab one barehanded before they'd sting you. Even then, it's going to be very, very mild in terms of the pain associated with it. So they're just these beneficial native pollinators. They're one of our about 500 or so bee species that we have here in Wisconsin.
Don, thank you again for calling. Barbara in Milwaukee, we go to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Love the show, and I especially love when PJ's on, so I can ask. I'm trying to help a friend do a weeding and mulch project under some black spruce. He was in there earlier this year when it was very dry and was just inundated with what the doctors say was chiggers.
Chiggers. When are they going to die off?
I wish I had a good answer for you, Larry. I have noticed in particular both this year and last year a distinct increase in reports that I attribute to chiggers, where someone is doing outdoor work, they come in and hours later they notice welts and bite marks around where socks had been, pants legs. I really think they've thrived with the drier conditions we've had. So kind of ties in with what we talked about a couple minutes ago, but I'm hoping if next year is rainy, that might help out. Otherwise, hard to tell when those chiggers in the activity may drop off for us.
It could be a while, though.
Yes.
Okay. PJ Leash, our guest today, PJ, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and you'll be with us up until 12:30 today. We are going to take a look now at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with PJ. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the world of insects on the show today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Hope you'll join in with your own insect questions at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Mike in Hudson next. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. So I have 40 acres up in Bayfield County, part of this farm that I grew up on. And I was up there about 10 days ago, and the gentleman that does some cropping here hayed for me on that parcel, also the logger. We've noticed that there's several dozen nice spruce trees that are completely dead. And his theory was that the pine beetle came in with these wildfires. Through this, which of course we know is very smoky this year. And I'm wondering if there's any, that's possible, but it's a much larger number of dead trees than I would normally see in any given, you know, year to year.
Sure.
Yeah, so the caller had mentioned specifically a pine beetle. We know in the western U.S. there is an insect called the mountain pine beetle, which has just wreaked a lot of havoc out there. Some good news is we don't have that one here in Wisconsin. However, I have seen in general at the Insect Diagnostic Lab lots of samples coming through of dead conifers, pines, spruces, you name it. What I think is going on is our weather conditions the last 2 to 3 years have been extremely stressful. If you have been in a spot where things have been dry and droughty multiple consecutive years, that can put a lot of stress on a tree, be it an evergreen or a hardwood tree or whatnot. There's a whole bunch of insects out there called bark beetles. There's other ones as well. And I really think of these as secondary insects. They are almost, in some cases, almost more of a symptom than a cause. So what's happening, I think, is these trees are stressed due to weather-related conditions. They are basically starting to die because of that. And then all these insects get in. And in some cases, again, these insects really are not very aggressive at all. But people will see them. They see the holes in the trees. And they say, aha, these bark beetles killed these trees. And in a lot of cases, it's, no, the trees were dying. Therefore, bark beetles showed up. So I suspect it may be weather related. I know for certain conifers, there have been some insect issues popping up here and there, but I think looking at the state of a whole, there's a lot of drought related stress, which can be very hard on plants.
Oh, there you go, Mike. Thank you for calling. Jim in Hollandale, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. Can you hear me? Okay?
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
Okay. I'm not sure if I have a question, but a real concern. I have the DNR tree pathologist out, because I noticed some dying of our 300- and 400-year-old black and bur oaks. And he referenced what I think I remembered, the two-line beetle that gets under the bark and is killing our trees. It's very sad. And there isn't much we can do. Is there any comment or hope that your guest could give us on that? Maybe you've talked about it.
I think PJ's got some remarks for that.
Yes, Larry, definitely. And actually, the story with this is very similar to the last story I told with the spruces and stress and bark beetles. Again, the last 2 to 3 years, depending on where you're located in the state, we have been very, very dry. That can put a lot of stress onto oak trees. Now, also depending on where you are in the state, we have had an insect called spongy moth, used to be called gypsy moth, now it's called spongy moth. But that spongy moth has been very, very abundant, and it's thrived because of dry conditions. So we have a lot of oak trees in the state that are experiencing stress, not only from drought stress, but also significant defoliation by spongy moth. You have that double whammy, very, very stressed trees. Once they are weakened and compromised in stress, then that opens the door for this opportunistic secondary borer called the two-line chestnut borer. Then it gets in, especially in the upper canopy, smaller branches. It starts causing some dieback. And unless you get some ideal conditions to help those trees recover, it's often this process over a couple years where trees can ultimately die from that. Now, it depends on context. If you have, say, one or two oaks, small number of oaks in your yard, there are some treatments that arborists can do in cases like that. It's more feasible to provide supplemental water to individual trees. But if you have a large wooded area, we just don't have treatments or any way to water large numbers of trees like that. So it's going to be kind of a natural process. There's a lot of things that may be going on that could take out some of the weaker trees out there.
Sorry about that, Jim. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Laura in Duluth, Minnesota next. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I'm calling about yellow jackets that are going in and out of a hole in my wall on the exterior up near the eaves at the peak of the roof. And I did get a wasp and hornet spray that you can... we'd have to go from our deck to try to get spray at the hole. But I'm concerned about when to spray, because I wouldn't want to trap them in there. And we've already had a few come into the house from somewhere inside.
Yeah, so we had a call along these same lines earlier in the show today. But just to recap a scenario like this very briefly, when a yellow jacket nest is in a structure and it's essentially inaccessible, we really don't want to use the aerosol wasp sprays. When you use those, the droplets tend to settle. They stick and cling to where they were applied to, vinyl siding or brick or things like that. And the insects can still kind of fly in and fly out, and they tend to not pick up a whole lot of it. So those aerosol sprays work pretty poorly in cases like this. What would work much better would be to find a product at the hardware store, or order online, which is formulated as a dust or powder. It might have the same exact ingredient as the aerosol spray, but it's a dust or powder. We can then use a bulb duster, or some of the products have a bottle so you can squeeze and puff it into those entrance points where they're coming and going from. You'd want to do this at night, especially if it's a cool night. They're not going to be active under conditions like that. Then when daytime comes and the insects resume their activity, as they leave and come back to the nest, they're going to pick up some of those dust particles, track it farther into the nest. So it almost works like a bait in that regard, that they're bringing it back to the rest of the colony. That is going to be much more successful. Now, anytime I'm talking with someone and they have concerns about stings, or they're just unsure of doing it, hiring a pest control professional is always a consideration in a case like this. If you have concerns like that, they're going to have products and tools on hand to do that sort of treatment if needed. But go with a dust type powder in a case like this.
Laura, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. PJ, you mentioned grasshoppers earlier in the show, and why are they more common and or seem to be more common this time of year?
Yes, I really feel it's weather related again. Like so many things we've talked about on today's show, we know in general grasshoppers tend to thrive under hot and dry conditions, and we've certainly had some dry conditions in Wisconsin this year. Looking at the bigger picture, so in the state, we've got about 70 or so species of grasshoppers. A lot of them are going to look very similar to the naked eye. We've got a lot of species out there. They're always around to a certain extent, and usually they are not any sort of problem for people or plants, that sort of thing. When I think of grasshopper issues, you go to the western U.S., Wyoming, Montana. Out there, grasshoppers can be a very, very significant crop pest for farmers to deal with on corn and other plants. Now that we've had a couple of consecutive dry years in the state, it's getting to the point where grasshopper populations are high enough. I'm starting to bump into some situations of grasshopper damage on plants, which is not common for us here in the upper Midwest. They will be general foliage feeders on small trees and shrubs. They can actually chew on thin bark where maybe it's a little bit greener, tender tissue and cause some damage like that. So I think it's weather-related, Larry. If you're a grasshopper, there's a lot of things that are trying to eat you or kill you. This can include pathogens. And during rainy years, those pathogens often kick in and keep grasshopper populations lower. When we have dry conditions, it releases grasshoppers from those pressures and their populations can explode. So I think that's the story to tell with grasshoppers this year.
Camille in New Berlin actually sent a picture of carpenter bee nests. She had those nests treated three times this year. Could she seal the holes now with putty?
Yeah, I think at this point, because those have been dealt with, it certainly seems appropriate to fill those up with putty. I would still keep an eye on those next year just to see if there was any emergence. But if you leave that open and you get moisture in there over the winter, that could be a bad thing. So I think it makes sense that those could be sealed up now. Just in general, with carpenter bees, we don't see much of them, but they do occur in southeastern Wisconsin especially. And one very common theme I see with these is they go to softer wood, pine and cedar, especially if it's unstained or unpainted. So having a good thick coat of paint or varnish or some other coating on that wood can also be a really good deterrent for future potential issues with carpenter bees.
Daniel in Hortonville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Daniel.
Hello, man. Hey, I have a little story or whatever, but it's kind of gross, so bear with me. I had a big cut on my hand last summer, and there was skin, you know, jagged skin, whatever, hanging from the wound or whatever. And I was sitting out in the sun, kind of sunning it, and a wasp flew in right on my hand on that wound, and took a chunk of the skin scab part out of it and took a big chunk and flew away. So I was kind of wondering what kind of wasp that would be.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. It does sound like it probably would have been something from the yellow jacket group. Now, between the genus Vespula and Dahlica Vespula, we've got over a dozen species here in the upper Midwest. And if you split that group out even finer. There are some of these species that have smaller colonies. Those wasps tend to be pretty strict in their behavior in that they're almost always predatory on other insects. There are some other yellow jacket species that can have larger colonies. They can be a little bit more kind of open-ended in terms of what they will feed upon. They will attack insect prey. They can also be scavengers. They can go to roadkill and stuff like that. And there are some reports in the literature of these causing harm to either humans or typically things like livestock. You have a horse or cow that gets a scrape outside and a wound, and sometimes these wasps can come and clip off some of that jagged skin as a protein source. They want to bring that back to the colony because this time of the year, they're desperate. They're looking for any sort of food that they can find. So I don't hear of these sorts of cases often, but that does fit the profile of the behavior for some of our yellow jacket wasps.
Yeah, very interesting, Daniel. Thank you for calling. Dan in Delavan emailed us. He's having issues with earwigs inside his house just the last couple of weeks. What would cause this sudden invasion and how can he stop them?
Yeah, earwigs have been really interesting this year, Larry. Typically, if I wanted to have a lot of earwigs, I'd probably make some damp conditions for them. That's what they like, is damp, dark conditions. This year has been really dry, but I almost wonder if that has forced them closer to structures. And if you can imagine a yard where the only plants getting watered are maybe your flower plant beds close to the house, and meanwhile your lawn is dormant, that might have concentrated them closer to the structure. Now, if we get some rains, and some parts of the state have gotten a bit more rain recently, if things got too wet in those areas, it might make them wander a bit more. Also, based on their life cycle, we're getting to the point of the year where there's just more of them in general compared to earlier in the season. And we know they like to get into nooks and crannies, cracks and crevices. And so if you look at a typical home, if you got vinyl siding or something like that, there's a lot of points that they can squeeze in. Looking at the bigger picture and how to prevent it, I would focus on what we call physical exclusion, sealing things up better, maybe doing things like checking weather stripping, make sure that is in good repair, replacing if need be, look for cracks and crevices. If you can fill things up with expanding insulation foam or caulk or backer rod or something like that, if things are sealed up snug, it's going to be harder for them to get indoors. That can be really, really helpful in the long run.
Dale emailed wondering if they something they heard really works. If you crocheted a fake wasp or hornet nest, hung it in an area that the wasp or hornet groups would not build a nest or take any residence nearby.
Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to work. And actually, it's really interesting if you dig into the literature on yellow jackets. So we've got these overwintering queens. The vast majority of those are going to fail. And actually, there are some that maybe the queens pop out a little bit later. They're trying to play catch up. And a very common thing that they will do is go to pre-existing wasp nests and try to take it over. They'll fight to the death with that queen, duke it out, and if they win, they take over that nest and claim it as theirs. So simply if there's a nest there, I don't think it's necessarily going to deter them. In fact, sometimes they are seeking out nearby nests. So I haven't heard or seen of any evidence of that working.
Sonia in Duluth, Minnesota emailed, they found a bot fly larvae in their house. It looks to be the fontanelle variety from rodents. They have two cats, a crawling baby, and a toddler. So given the nature of these bugs, they're a bit freaked out. They got rid of the pupa or larva, but should they expect more, how can they be rid of this? The cats use a catio. Otherwise, they don't go outside, and they do have mice that their cats have been catching.
Okay. So I think the key word there is mice, Larry. If you're seeing these indoors, they're almost always associated with mice. Over the years, I've seen one or two of these in my own house where I've got a mouse in a mouse trap. That mouse had recently died, and there's a larva that crawled its way out. So in a case like this, I'd really focus on good rodent control practices, you know, doing trapping, checking those traps regularly so that if you do happen to catch a mouse, if you can get rid of it quickly, that is going to eliminate the chances of having a botfly larva around. Now, looking at the bigger picture too, just because you have a larva around, there's really no concern with that. They're not able to move to another host. They really have to start in a host and complete their development there. So it's more of a curiosity, although a lot of folks aren't going to be particularly keen about that, but focus on rodent control in this case. That should help you out.
We got another photo of a bur oak, a young bur oak, from Terry. The underside of the leaves, there are some little growths there. What are they, and should Terry deal with them? And I think it's perhaps similar to the earlier photo.
It definitely is, Larry. These are another type of gall. They just have a kind of plate-like or saucer-like shape. There are some that look like this that are simply called saucer galls. There are some other ones called spangle gall. There's an amazing diversity out there in terms of galls on oaks. In this case, there's no need for concern. These galls are merely a curiosity, a kind of an oddity. They look a little different, but really doesn't have any impact on the long-term health of those plants. There's nothing you can do about it anyway. Those leaves are going to be dropping off soon, and next year is another roll of the dice. You might see a lot of galls next year. You might see relatively few, but in the grand scheme of things, it's just something cool to notice out in nature.
Our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, noticed many people are posting about the twice-stabbed lady beetle. What does the twice-stabbed lady beetle look like?
Yeah, so there's a lot of really interesting names out there for lady beetles and insects in general, but there happens to be a type of lady beetle that's a little bit smaller than some of our common ones called a twice-stabbed lady beetle, and it's a distinctive black appearance with a red spot on each of the wing covers. So maybe the blood red and stabbed, there's a connection there, but that's the twice-stabbed lady beetle. That one tends to specialize in terms of what they prey upon. They're beneficial predators, and they're really fond of feeding on scale insects, which have been lurking out there this year. I haven't had my phone flying off the hook with calls about them, but I know they're always out there. So if you have a magnolia, a tree or bush or shrub, or trees with scale insects present, you probably have some of these around. They're helping in the long run control those scale insect populations.
Josh emailed us. They have so many earwigs this year in the house and out, and they're eating into their Congo Trinidad very hot peppers.
Wow. I have not heard of that before, Larry. I will say, though, I do get some reports of earwig damage to plants from time to time. Typically, it is plants that are kind of lower growing or have a canopy that folds over towards the ground and holds moisture in. So I think of ferns, hostas, marigolds, things like that that hold the moisture in, make some good habitat for earwigs to hang out. So that's a new one for me. I can't say I've heard of earwig damage on pepper plants before.
And Patty in Rockdale called but couldn't stay with us. She came across a menacing-looking wasp this spring, but before she was about to kill it, but she looked it up. It was a great golden dagger or digger wasp. It's actually friendly, and she says it can recognize people.
Those are fun to watch, and there's a couple different species of these very large solitary ground-nesting wasps. There's great golden digger wasps, cicada killers, great black wasps. They do look a little bit intimidating in terms of their size, but if you can remain calm and just watch them, they're fascinating creatures to watch. They will make a nest. The female goes out, hunts for prey, brings it back, has to do all that hard work by herself. They can also be beneficial pollinators too, and very, very unlikely that they'd ever sting you.
On that happy note, we're out of time, PJ. Thank you so much for being with us. I certainly look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
PJ Leash, our guest. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He does such a great job. And he'll be back again. We answered a lot of questions today, and it was a lot of fun as well. Looking ahead to tomorrow on the show, our top travel agent is back to help you plan a unique fall or winter vacation. Plus, we hear the story of the first Brigade Band, which started in Broadhead. That's tomorrow at 11 on The Larry Mueller Show. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.